10 different uses of the truck.
All right,
let's see. Yes, then again, all right, final words on it. Yes, I think we're going to deal with some problems here with the accident. And I think one of the tools we did would surely fit into this category. So we want to do this type of five-quarts wavelength dipole. I think both and do basically some of the matching techniques that we did with the flip chart to visually see what is going on. All right, very good. Let's see. All right, so now I don't feel like you want to do a little bit more, over.
Yeah, we can take on at least another one now, Mel. Also, since Mel has a series of two or three consecutive lectures on the subject of Smith chart, a person who says, where can I get a copy of that? You can hear it live. I'll admit the audio is not hi-fi, but it's there. You can hear it live by going to the right website. There's a beautiful guy in New Jersey who is doing his labor of love of recording all this jazz that Mel and I and you other guys are doing. And it is available by going to the right website. You go to amateurradio.tv, www.amateurradio, with a double R, the end of amateur and the beginning of radio, they both have an R, no punctuation, amateurradio.tangovictor. TV. Not .com, not .org, .tangovictor. You go there, and you go to the TechNet, and you'll find that every one of the TechNets for the last year or so, every 5 minutes of what we talked about is documented. It comes in 1 hour reels. Our typical TechNet these days is 3 hours and a fraction long, and so you go down the list and say, hey, there's a subject I want to hear about. It's on reel number 3 of August 14th, 2007. You go to that reel and you play it and you'll hear it live. So it's all recorded. And so if you want to review Mel's Smith chart use examples, with a little bit of research we'll find out what date it was, and you go to that date and there it is. And you can play it back. So all those recordings are available. The price is right. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger, believe it or not, I got a number of offers if I wanted to actually go and really do some classwork on showing different applications of the Smith chart. Somewhat of a revival of the Smith chart. However, I'm not really up on a number of the computerized versions of the Smith chart tech. I know the old manual ways, you know, as I was doing it, you know, with a compass in hand and all. Are you familiar with some of the more computerized methods of application of the chart takeover?
Yes, I am. I have in my handheld calculator one single formula. It's a great big long formula with a bunch of sines and cosines on the top of the equation and a bunch of sines and cosines on the bottom of the equation. You plug in the numbers of what impedance is the transmission line you're using, what is the exact impedance of the load you care about, the resistive component and the reactive component. So you define the load, you define the Z0 of the transmission line, you tell it how long the transmission line is in wavelength or in degrees, and it will tell you what is the input impedance of that line when you have that load on the output and that line at that length. So I can play with the numbers and say, gee, if I use a transmission line of this length, I'll get this input impedance, and the resistive component is just right, except the reactive component is left over, and I put a step at that location, and now the reactive component goes away. So you could say, built into my handheld calculator, is an equation that gives me the raw data by which I can do Smith chart matching of that technique. That's not the only technique. It's just the technique that, to me, is convenient. So I sometimes will go back to a Smith chart and do it graphically and see if I come out with the right same answer, just to be double down sure, before I go out and buy all the hardware and cut all the coax cable. So there are computer programs that do it beautifully. I don't even have a computer program. I've just got that equation, that'll do that impedance prediction for me. And therefore, I use that in my occupation, and 95% of the time, it solves the problem. K2KE1, K2LIW.
HWW with a question, please.
Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, when you're, you know, you talked last week about these using, you know, an open and a short. Now, when you put them on a transmission line, do they have to be a half wave apart? If I remember right, that if you're trying to gang together, or let's say you multiple stuff to get even a deeper notch, they have to be exactly a half wave apart. Is that correct?
When you're using a stub to notch a frequency, there are some magic lengths where you get the maximum performance of more than one notch, of more than one stub. Yes, there are magic distances for more than one stub, and is it half wave or quarter wave? I think it's quarter wave, but I'm not positive of that. But there are magic distances where the performance multiplies almost instead of adds. But if you're making a resonator, you can put both stubs at the exact same location, one an open circuit and one a short circuit, or one a short circuit long and a short circuit short, so to speak. So there are ways, if you read that page 60 of the October issue, where you can put more than one stub in one location to synthesize an extremely high Q, very low loss, completely shielded resonator. And whether you use that resonator to pass your favorite frequency, or whether you use that resonator to notch out your favorite frequency, is your choice and how you design it. So, yes, there are magic lengths, and there are some cases where the length can be made zero for a particular application, like making a resonator. A band pass filter, you might want to put the two stubs at the same location. Back to you, Howie.
Right, because if you're doing, let's say, the duplexer, you have certain electrical line, I think you're halfway. Excuse me. Every halfway, the impedance is going to repeat itself. So would you want to have a quarter wave where one thing may be, you'll be, you know, out of phase, looking back at the other piece of stub? So wouldn't they have to be a half wave?
Half wave would put the two stubs in the same location as putting both stubs. If I put them half wave apart, Howie, because impedance repeats in a half wave, half wave apart is the same as putting them both in the same location. If I put them a quarter wave apart, think of what you're doing. A quarter wave away from a short circuit is an open circuit. So if the first stub is making a short at the frequency you want to notch out, and a quarter wave from that, the short circuit becomes an open circuit. That's the highest impedance you're going to get. And you put another shorting stub there, my goodness, is that going to suck it down? So two stubs that are trying to notch out a frequency, I think they should be a quarter wave apart, not a half wave apart. If they're a half wave apart, it's the same thing as putting them both in the same location. Back to you, Howie.
It makes sense. I gotta try making coaxial cables. I wonder what kind of band pass, what kind of percentage will you get on a curve? Let's say you try it at 10 meters. That would be very interesting. But I use half wave stubs, you know, quarter wave stubs, shorted, and they work very nicely for getting rid of the second harmonic, and they also work great. I haven't tried using an open, you know, doing a resonator. Well, what kind of window do you think you would get? Do you think you get a very sharp window?
You can get any window you want, Harry. When you make the stub shorter than quarter wavelength, it is now not an open circuit. It is a inductive reactance. So by making one of them an eighth wave long, you've got a certain amount of inductive reactance, and another one an eighth wave long as an open stub, you've got a certain amount of capacitive reactance. That is a certain L to C ratio, but on a 50 ohm line, it's going to give you a certain bandwidth. If you now make the stubs, both stubs, shorter yet, or you're going to make the shorting stub shorter yet, instead of a quarter wavelength long, instead of an eighth wave long, you're going to make it a 16th wavelength long. That's not making a 50 ohm reactor, that's making a 25 ohm inductive reactor. And you choose the right length of open circuit stub that gives you the same amount of capacitive reactance, you now have a higher C to L ratio, and you've got a sharper inductor, a sharper resonator on that 50 ohm line. The one thing about a stub is you're always working with a 50 ohm or a 70 ohm line. but you can decide, do I want big inductors and small capacitors, or do I want small inductors and big capacitors, capacitor reactors? You can make it resonate with a very short stub, and as you make the stub shorter and shorter, and the reactance of the stub gets smaller and smaller, and you still resonate it, you're going to get a sharper and sharper curve. So you can choose the loaded curve, you can choose the loaded Q that you want by how far you push these inductors into smaller or larger reactances. By choosing the right length, you can make the capacitor reactance anything you want, you can make the inductor reactance anything you want. So you can synthesize a resonator with a 2 Henry, a 1 Henry, or a 2 nano Henry inductor, and make it resonate at your frequency by choosing the right length of the short and the open stud. I think you see the principle. Back to you, Harry.
Absolutely. The first thing you do is you do your square root of LC, find out what L and C you want, and then you work backwards, because then you find out what's the reactive at that frequency, and then you look to see. And that's where you can use the Smith chart. You know, I'll tell you, it's a very cheap way to make stuff. And you don't need a big can, I'll tell you that much.
Got it. These are very low-loss inductors and capacitors. They are rated for transmitting power levels, and they're thoroughly shielded, and they're simple, and they're cheap. Other than that, they work good. Why the hell haven't we been using them before this? How come this guy in the October 2007 issue on page 60 had to bring this up again to us? This is a technique that was developed in the 1920s. And here we are, 80 years later, reinventing it. And I think the problem is, for a short period of time, we got so enthralled with these rigs with all the horns and whistles that we can buy from Southeast Asia, that we have become appliance operators. That's how we got into the state. Not enough home brewing going on. This is an opinion. I'm not saying appliance operators are wrong, but the real ham radio operators get their hands dirty, and they do some soldering, and they build some things. And they know these techniques, and they share them with each other. The guys up on the microwave band are discussing this kind of jazz day in and day out and teaching each other this stuff. The appliance operators down on 40 meters who have never built a rig, and they just laid down their money, they wrote the check, and they start talking in front of the microphone, and they're talking about politics and girls and whatever, and they're enjoying it, and they're learning something. But if they were building and going up to the higher frequencies, they'd be learning a lot more, a lot faster. That's an opinion. It's a little bit sad that we had to reinvent this technique. It's been around for 80 years. K2RIW. I'm not angry. I just have some fun with you guys.
Hey, this is KTY. Well, I think one of the tutelage we did was on stubs, how to determine stubs. I gave an example of a emergency type of situation that you needed to put a stub together for a field day operation, if you remember, and how to determine, you know, what the stub, where to put the stub, how long it is, the whole business, if you remember. I went through that whole thing, Dick. So I've done that thing with stubs a number of times. What they have, they ask me, you know, basically I can say, actually, I can do this shot, you know, the old manual fashion with a compass and everything like that. And that's the way I seem to be able to envision most of the time what is going on when I actually make a drawing, you know, by hand with the compass and the straight edge and everything like that. That's to me, the old-fashioned really knows what they still offer you online, literally, is those Smith charts that you can, you know, download them, and they still work quite well. As far as I'm concerned, I still like that method, even though I guess I'd be called a dinosaur. All right, anything else on this, or should we go on?
Well, I'll say one thing, the red one, they usually are red on white paper. Yeah, Dick, I tell you, I've been working with, listening to you. I got started playing with stuff last year when I put up the 10-meter repeater, and I had to notch out the second harmonic, and I'll tell you, I used a piece of LMR 400, and we shorted it one end. I'll tell you, on the tracking analyzer, getting about 40 dBs with one stub, That and the harmonic filter in the transmitter solve a lot of problems.
Yeah, these stuff are beautifully shielded, transmitter rated. I mean, if you and I go out and buy a transmitter rated variable capacitor, it's a great big hunk of material with great big plates and air spaces and whatever in order to handle transmitting power levels and voltages. And it takes up a lot of volume and it costs a lot of money. And as long as you don't have to have a continuously variable capacitor, as long as you're smart enough to calculate ahead of time how many picofarads or nanohenries you want, you choose the right length of coax cable, put a short circuit at one end, put a connector on the other end, connect it with your key connector into your line, the stub is there, and it's shielded, weatherproofed, power rated, transmitter power rated, high in Q, low in loss, automatic works well, and it's cheap. Boy, that's a bargain. How can you beat that? And the equation that allows you to calculate how long a stub you want is on page 60. Yeah, the second equation has got a mistake. He's got tangent twice, and he should have cotangent. But that's an easy one, though. He should have used cotangent in the second equation and tangent in the first equation, like he did. But other than that minor error, the equations for calculating it, so that you can do it mathematically or with a Smith chart as a backup, whichever you want, a lot of the information is in that article. And if you go to other references, if you take those buzzwords and you Google those buzzwords of stub tuners, I guarantee you'll find a zillion articles that have been written over the years that are on the web, easy to download, some of them with some beautiful illustrations showing you how to do it. A little bit sad that we've had to reinvent this technique, but at least it hasn't been lost. The art and the science is there, and we can do it. And for the modern-day calculator that can handle complex mathematics, it's pretty difficult. It's pretty easy. Even a calculator that doesn't handle mathematics, just a four-function calculator with a little bit of smart, can do it for you. Because a smart guy can independently calculate the I's, independently calculate the Q's, square the I's, square the in-phases, square the out-of-phases, sum them together, take the square root of the result. He knows the impedance of the combination. So you can write your own equations that do the equivalent of complex mathematics, even if you have nothing but a $5 four-function calculator in front of you. It's just a learning curve. Takes a little bit of practice. Not easy the first time, but it's worth the investment, in my opinion. Point made, I think. K2KUI, K2RIW. Go to another one if you want to.
K2L.
Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, I think it was Milton that said that consists of some old-fashioned because he uses this chart, but I have access to all the high-end simulators, and that's how I work. I work in the Smith chart. That's how I mess things. What other way is there, really? As far as, I look graphically, I say, okay, this is inductive, this is capacitive. What better way is there?
When it comes to representing the data graphically, there's nothing better than the Smith chart. You take, for instance, an MRF-899, very modern transistor in 1995, and its input and output impedance is plotted on a Smith chart with a bunch of dots with frequency. And you can see how the impedance crawled along a line on the Smith chart as you sweep from 800 to 900 megacycles. That's where the transistor is designed. It's designed for 800 to 900, but it's really probably usable from 700 to 1200. A beautiful transistor. And from you guys, I'm finding out there's some beautiful LD MOS transistors that are a little bit more modern, that probably have more gain, a little bit easier to use. So there's some great devices out there nowadays if you want to build solid state at the multi-hundreds of watts level. It gets a little bit difficult when you get to the kilowatt and beyond. But at the multi-hundreds of watts, there's lots of devices that are not too expensive. If you bought them brand new, they're a little bit expensive. But you buy the right piece of surplus equipment that used to be 900 megacycle paging equipment or 880 megacycle cell phone equipment, and all of that stuff, tremendous amounts of it, is on eBay right now, being sold at 5 and 10% of the original cost. And some of it is in pristine condition with the original label on it that's never been broken, so that the seal has never been broken. Some of these things are virgin pieces of equipment that have never been turned on. Not a single bit of dust inside. You can tell that the the original plastic package that it was wrapped in is still there. And so you're getting essentially brand new equipment. The date codes on them tell you it's built in 1998, which to me is modern enough. And when it works that well, and it's that efficient, and it's that well designed, and it's that beefy, and it can take a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio forever at any phase angle, how the hell can you go wrong? Any further words on that, Steve? Thank you, how I bet you.
Okay, I can see you sold on the EMF 899. I tried to use that device. Actually, I designed an amplifier around that with 2-1 bandwidth. It was 502,000 megs. And thermal resistance was way too high for what I was doing. You might want to look into that if you want to go CW. Probably good for PEP, in my opinion. Okay. But still, the Smith chart is like the easiest way of looking at something right away and saying, okay, I know how to match that. Especially if you put on, like a bolted mittens and suspended, you're done. You can see exactly what's going on. So it's not antiquated. It's still modern.
Now, that transistor, Steve, is designed for 800 to 900 megs. You push the design for 500 to 1,000. Guarantee you had to work pretty hard. You were going pretty far beyond what the original design of the device was for. I didn't say it doesn't work down there at 500, and doesn't work up there at 1,000. I'm just saying it was designed for 800 to 900. It's got a certain amount of internal impedance matching built in, and you had to go pretty far beyond that. I guarantee you worked pretty hard to make it work over that frequency range. I'm using that exact transistor. I'm getting 150 watt output, T down, per stage. It's doing exactly what Motorola says it's supposed to do at that frequency range. Now back to you, Steve.
Hey, my question is, what's the efficiency as far as power into, I guess you should probably include the, make it power efficiency, include the input power and all that. What's the efficiency? Again, more than the 40% they claim for that?
I think they claim something like 43%. And by the way, the true efficiency you get, you can make the efficiency go to probably 80% if you're willing to run Class C. I want linear amplification. I want sideband capability. So I'm running it AV1, AV2 type stuff. And as such, I'm getting a little over 40% if I remember correctly. I haven't calculated it. I know what I'm getting is in the right ballpark. If they claim 41 and I'm getting 39, I'd say, to me, that's good enough. That last little bit of efficiency doesn't matter as long as I'm not running from a battery. As long as I'm running from a stateside power, no sweat. I will admit that I was running from a battery. I would probably be running it Class C, and I would be using envelope restoration single sideband technique in order to get both linearity and efficiency simultaneously. That's the Carl Mainzer technique that he used on the Oscar satellite, envelope restoration. In other words, his actual transistorized amplifier was running pure Class C, but he modulated the C-plus voltage, the B-plus voltage, I would call it. He modulated the B-plus voltage depending on how big an envelope he was making at that instant of time. So the poor transistor was continuously running Class C. It didn't even know it was doing amplitude modulation. And the B-plus going up and down was being done with a very fast operating switching regulator. Back to you, Steve.
Hey, you were using the CON technique, he was using the CON technique, the EER. I've been experimenting, with the Class E amplifier doing that kind of thing. But my problem with the 899 was, I think I achieved pretty close to 40% efficiency. And at the 450 watts, the junction temperature, they were pretty high. Probably exceeding 175 degrees C. That's what the problem I had with that transistor was. I got a lot more efficiency at the LDMOS. Even though the, phase JC was not much more, or not much less, I should say.
Yeah, you were up to those 175 degree junction temperatures because you were not starting off with a 25 degree centigrade heat sink temperature. I think if you were up at full spec, you were probably starting off with a 70 degree heat sink temperature. Is that true, Steve?
No, actually, it was a liquid cooled system, and I think it was only about 45 degrees, something like that. I think if you look at the theta JC on that part, it's going to be in the it's going to be over 1 degree C per watt. And I'm trying to think now. Yeah, and you're dissipating more than 150 watts, so it's getting up there.
Yeah. I will admit that the 600 watts was a two-tone test as far as the data sheet is concerned. That's not 600 watts key down, 600 watts peak and, oh, correction, 150 watts per stage peak and below power two-tone test, in which case the dissipation is a hell of a lot smaller. You're right. If I wanted 150 watts key down forever, yes, I'm pretty sure I would be pushing the state-of-the-art of a junction temperature rise due to internal thermal resistance. Did you find an LD MOS transistor in the 900 meg region with 150 watt region of power output? Is there such a device that you know of, Steve?
Well, I can say that when I went with a Motorola part with a MRF-184S and a pair of those, actually I took a pair of those, sized them down to the base plate, made a push-pull, and that was 120 watts device instead of 150. But the thermal resistance for the combined pair, I'm trying to think now, what was it? It came out to about 0.55 degrees C per watt, something like that. It was a lot lower. And it was more efficient. That's what I went with.
Now, the MRF-184 Sierra, is that 120 watts per transistor or 120 watts for a push-pull pair?
120 watts for a push-pull pair. But it was more efficient. I got more efficiency, more gain, and a little bit less power.
Now, the MRF-899, somewhere around 8.5 dB of gain. What kind of gain were you getting out of the 184M?
I'm sorry, I guess it's more gain, actually. I got about 10 dB at 1 gig.
Very nice. What's your guess as to the gain at 900 meg?
11 dB. If I optimize it for 1100 megs, maybe a little bit more, maybe 11.5. But they make some bigger parts, actually now, I think. I haven't really been looking, but that was back in 1998. And, I compared the two devices. I went with the, LD MOS.
And I think you said there are people who make better LD MOSes. I think Motorola has almost given up on power transistors. And what brand name? You've given me some brand names in the past. Just give me one or two brand names now that make 150 watt class LD MOS 900 meg transistors. Name a brand name.
Okay, Freescale took over the Motorola line. I think actually some of the second generation parts have more gain and probably at least as much power. I took PolyFed. And let's see, Freescale, PolyFed. I'm not doing this anymore, so I'm just working from memory. I'm trying to think now. Cree, you might want to look at CREE. And that's all I can think of offhand right now.
And thank you, Steve. Those are some good leads. Mel, back to you. And why don't you choose another one? The choice is yours.
Oh, the KTY. All right, let's see. What I can put out. Okay. This is one from a person by the name of Doyle. Hey, Doyle, what would you want? I have a older receiver, but it's quite a good receiver. I like it very much, but with all the new roofing filters, DSP, and all these things, you had mentioned in the past, that I made filters, crystal filters, using crystals, and would you say that this is worth the effort? I'm looking basically, I am a CW operator. Yeah, I can more or less, I think we did a thing on this, if I'm not mistaken. Do you remember something we did on Butterworth filters, ladder filters, crystal ladder filters systems. I think we did something on that in the past. Maybe it's on there on the past Poodle. I don't remember, but I thought we somewhat got into that. Am I correct over there?
There was a guy in Manhattan Beach. His call letters were K2KEY. He did about a 6-month study on crystal lattice filters. He did that about 2.5 or 3 years ago, to my knowledge. I could be a little wrong on the date. And the current websites that go back on the recordings of the TechNet right now don't go back that far. I think the New Jersey man does have recordings that go back, and maybe he's going to be putting those up on the website at a later time. But right now, I think he only goes back approximately 1 year. So that particular set of discussions that you were doing might not be available on the website at this time, no. Also, I know you were trying to build a very high-tech, high-performance filter. I know you spent quite a bit of time collecting all of the quartz crystals to do it, selecting the ones with the right center frequency, the right internal series equivalent resistance, the right internal Q, and so on. It was a fairly significant effort. If a person right now doesn't come from a background of having built a number of filters, if he doesn't have that experience under his belt, and he's now looking at the two paths of building his own roofing filter or going out and buying it and taking a week's salary to do it, I think he's ahead of the game to spend the week's salary. I'm exaggerating, you know what I mean, as opposed to spending 6 months of his life. That's my gut feel. Now, you're the guy who did it. You collected the crystals, you did all the study, you did all the experiments, you built the filter. It was a successful project. And you did it mostly for the learning curve and for the beauty of how they work and learning how they work and appreciating what they can do. But if a guy just wants the final product, it's a little bit similar to a man who wants a 6-inch diameter Newtonian telescope. He can spend 6 months of his life grinding the mirror, or he can spend a week's salary or half a week's salary and buy it. If your motivation is to look through the microscope, look through the telescope, and take a whole lot of astronomical pictures, buy the telescope. If it's the parabolic mirror grinding and correcting procedure, which is a lot of science and art, that's a fun thing to do if you like it. If that's what you want to do, go grind the mirror. But if it's the final product you want, write the check, and the problem goes away. So you have to make a decision what you really want. Do you want to learn the process? Do you want to understand the physics? Do you want to appreciate the procedure?
Repeater, timeout,
cancel. You want to enjoy the art and science of building procedure? Then go and build it. But if it's the final product you want because you want to go and do something with that, then buy it. So 90% of the people I know who might need a roofing filter, find somebody who's got it on the shelf and pay his price, or try to get one on the used flea market somewhere, or on eBay or whatever. Or maybe buy two filters that are close and combine them just right. There's crafty ways of doing things like that. Cascading filters with a little bit of an attenuator in between, and maybe adding an operational amplifier to increase the gain because of the loss of the second filter or whatever. There's ways you can do crafty things like that. But to go through what you went through to really build a top-of-the-line crystal rotted filter, there aren't many people who have the Mel Schneider enthusiasm that are willing to do that. That's what I think I saw. You're the guy who did it. Let's give us your impression of having done it. No. Away to the beep, K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, you've got to remember, I put a lot of effort and resources into building that receiver. So getting to the filter, when it came to the filter, I surely wasn't going to now, you know, throw my hands up and say that's it. There wasn't anything on the market at that time that really fit the basically what I was looking for. I was using, I have five column mechanical filters in the receiver besides what I was looking for at that time, particularly because of being, I could say, a CW operator and looking for those CW signals, which is a lot of fun to dig them out of, you know, some rare, very rare places. Sometimes you run into, I support some phenomenally rare DX stations that strictly work CW operators for two reasons. One, they didn't have to be pluses to, you know, buy rigs that could put enough power and antenna systems, and also they didn't speak English. A number of them did not speak English, and so CW was the way to go. The filter, I did construct one simple filter. I did construct it initially and started out with very simple filters. One of my Butterworth filters, I will mention, was not that complicated, but it did work out quite well because I was able to come up with a CW filter that I believe I remember I used only four crystals, and I was able to achieve fairly narrow, about 200 cycles. Yes. It was a 200 cycle, very nice, clean, neat, very, very good response. And that's what it grew from. But I did start, like I say, with basically four crystals. Now, working with the crystals, it is a problem. Like Dick said, I did put a lot of time and resources into it. First, I had to build a tester to test the crystals because you got to, before you proceed, you know, there's certain complications. Let me do that and drop first. Complications, first of all, you got to know about the crystal. The manufacturers of the crystals, of course, do not stamp the value of the L and the C on their crystals. To really determine these things, which are very important, especially the Q of the crystal, you got to make up some test pictures. So as Dick says, it's a toss-up. If you really want to learn about filters, I did learn a lot about filters. It is a study. Boy, oh boy, you could literally spend, I think, become an engineering. I think you could go to a company and say, all I know is filters. And I will bet you can find a job, Dick, in the filter division over.
Without a doubt. It's a rare art and science. Now, when it comes to a roofing filter on the front end of a receiver at the first IF, and if that IF is 70 megs or 21.4 megs, I would strongly recommend that be an analog filter, a real piece of hardware. And whether it be made out of quartz or ceramic resonators or whatever, it's just a matter of what is on somebody's shelf that's ready to be bought. But once you really get down to the narrowband IF at 10.7 megs, 9 megs, or 455 KC, then in 2007, I think you're well into the realm where digital signal processing chips, properly chosen, can give you what you can synthesize any bandwidth you want at any slope factor of the filter, any ringing factor, and shape factor, and the ripples and so on. Digital signal processing has a lot going for it. And that is the modern way. A software-designed receiver, software-regulated receiver, whatever it's called now. I can't think of the three-letter abbreviation. Software-controlled receiver are starting to become very popular in many commercial ends of the world. If you take a look at today's issue, Sunday Today, New York Times, I can't remember which section it is. I think it's the financial section. It talks about a man named Bose, who's now doing a kind of software-defined radio. And he's set up a business where he's now getting million-dollar contracts to replace the hardware being used in cell phone base stations with his software-defined radios. The advantage of a software-defined radio is that when somebody changes the protocol, when they go from CDMA to TDMA to GMRS and all these other kinds of GSM and so on, when they go from these various protocols of operating a cell phone and trying to build a cell phone to have international standards capability, a software-defined radio. You just change the computer program, and the thing keeps on flying. Before you start using a software-defined radio, you've got to buy new amplifiers, new filters, new mixers, new circulators, new antennas, and it just goes on and on and on. with a software-defined radio, it, as long as it covers the right frequency range and has the right power output capability, and if it's designed with enough adaptability and modulation technique, if it's got a full vector modulator and a full vector demodulator receiver function, all with software-defined digital signal processing, you do that correctly, and now you can build the radio once and in theory use it for the next 50 years, even though everybody changes protocol. And they invented more and more elaborate protocols with more and more security and so on. It doesn't matter. So to build a filter in the final IF bandwidth selecting area of the receiver and to build it in either analog hardware or digital signal processing, I strongly recommend you at least give consideration to the DSP technique. It's got a lot of spots being put in there these days. The chips are not expensive. There's a bit of a learning curve, but boy, are they capable. So if you were designing the 200 Hertz filter in your final IF today, Mel, would you still do it with analog hardware, or would you at least consider the latest that's available in not too expensive digital signal processing chips? K2KEY, K2RIW.
DR.
Okay,
I have it.
Mel first, then we'll pick up the other two people. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, well, I went out and I did purchase a very high-end radio that has all bells and whistles, and, there we go again with the dinosaur. If I listen to my receiver that uses, for instance, mechanical filters like Collins, my Butterworth type filters, Dick, I say to you this way, yes, the digital filter systems and all the new high-end systems that they've come up with that use microprocessing control and duplicate a lot of things. For some reason, if I set it down, and I guess if you listen with, I guess, our old ears, I like the natural sound. What can I do? To me, the sound quality, the purity of it, it seems to be with the old Collins mechanical filters, the Butterworth-type filters, that type of configuration. No doubt that the new receivers and everything is phenomenal pieces of equipment and all, but for some reason, if you said to me, which would you rather have, you know, which do you prefer? I prefer, basically, the older system. I know I'm going to get a lot of flack on this, but I'm going to get the same flack on this as I've been getting from the business with our Yagi and Quad talk. I have had so many emails on that, it's ridiculous. So here I go again, and they're going to say, I don't know what I'm talking about. Talking about, you know, Collins mechanical filters that came out in the 50s over.
WB2HWW, with a comment on that.
Yeah, we're going to get to you in a second, Howie. No, I think you're right. You take a guy who fell in love with a Marantz amplifier of 1960 vintage, and it's got nice, round, easy to tolerate distortion when you drive the amplifier beyond linearity. You compare that to a fairly modern day transistorized amplifier, and when it goes to distortion, it's a lot more dissonant. So some of the modern equipment has got a lot of advantages, but sometimes you give up a little bit. Many of the digital signal processing techniques have a hell of a lot of alias responses, as they're called, to the frequency response of the filter or the direct digital synthesizer. So a software-defined radio, SDR, I keep forgetting those letters. It's got a lot of advantages. It's got a tunable IF. It's got tunable notch filters. It's got variable bandwidth. It's got a lot of goodies. But if the guy doing the design was not seeking excellence, if he's just trying to get the job done in a hurry and keep it within some very restrictive cost constraint, he could easily have come up with a unit which, on paper, has got all those horns and whistles. But when you listen to those horns and whistles, it doesn't sound so good. That's easy to happen. the first transistorized radios that any of us could buy, let me drop, could very easily be overloaded. You put a 1985 transistorized receiver in the middle of a 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, and you would say, get that thing off my bench. It just couldn't tolerate strong signals. Well, a lot of amateurs voted with their pocketbook, and Southeast Asia responded and came up with very high dynamic range, modern-day solid-state receivers. Almost none of us use a tube receiver anymore. So they've corrected the thing that bothered us. And I think the digital signal processing, some of the fancy receivers with 40 horns and whistles, are going through that learning curve. And some of the early designs coming out have a lot of capability, but they've got some bugs in it. I'm going to give you that. I didn't say you should absolutely positively choose digital signal processing. I'm saying you should consider it. Let's see what Howie's going to say on that. Go ahead, Howie.
What I'm going to say, Dick, is that people who are older, like our generation, your generation, we have been brought up hearing those distortions. You know, if you listen to, let's say, a MP3 file on an iPod, you might walk away saying, you know, the iPod don't sound as well. There's information that you're hearing. Your body wants to hear that distortion. I mean, there's an old saying that you can take a tube amplifier and you can design a solid-state amplifier. In reality, a transistor is more linear than a tube because a transistor can operate over a wider range. You know, for an example, if you got a tube running on 200-volt swing, it can only swing to maybe 170. You can't come up to, you know, BCC or B+. A transistor might get there, you know, might come up to 0.1 volts of BCC and go to ground, like 0.1. And a tube can only go, let's say, from 30 to 170. In reality, a transistor might be more linear, but it's what we're used to listening to. If you take a younger person and put them on an iPod, you say, that sounds good. You put them on a tube receiver like a, you know, a Rance or one of those things, and he's got to tell you that the tube equipment sounds horrible. So it's all what you're used to, what you're accustomed to, Dick.
Hey, you're right, Helen. That's part of it. And what you've learned to... It turns out that nobody is born loving anything except his mother and what his mother can supply. I think you get the picture on that one. You're born loving your mother. Everything else, you have to learn to love it. You have to learn to like it. You have to get used to it. Everything else, with rare exception. So that's part of it. Was there another person who wanted to make a comment?
KQ2QIQ.
Mr. QIQ, start off with your name and then give us your comment, sir.
Yes, my name is Glenn, and just rehashing of that 900 megahertz transistor, and I was talking about earlier in earlier this evening. Have you looked at a part called an MRF9100 LR3 made by Motorola?
I'm about to. MRF9100 LR3. Is that an LD MOS, Glenn?
It's an N-channel enhanced load lateral MOSFET. Basically a 100-watt CW part. Operates around, you know, 26 volts. I got a couple of samples that I got. It comes in both surface mount and basically you can mount it down on pallet with cab. And I was able to get easily, you know, somewhere, you know, very, very short operation, 100 watts with just using some out in a test jig and basically using two very, very small trombones set around 3 inches on input and output. And I was able to easily get the 100 watts, and when I started pushing a little bit harder, I got even 150 out of it. So it's something you might want to look at. It's definitely a nice little MOSFET, and it's very linear as well.
My goodness, that sounds good. When you were getting roughly 100 watts out of it, Glenn, what's your guess as to how many decibels of gain you were getting out of that stage?
The data that I took showed somewhere, the spark's like optimized, somewhere like around 950 megahertz. I was getting almost like 17.2 dB gain. Granted, this is in a fixture with two sliding trombones in and out. You know, it certainly was not optimized. It was just trying to take data on the part. And I would say somewhere down like around 900 megahertz, department well into the 15 dB gain area, and I would say at about 1,000, like somewhere around 16.5.
Okay, so 15 dB gain at 900, 17 dB gain at 950, and I think it's a 16 dB gain at 1 gigahertz. So it sounds like it's optimized at 950. 17 and a fraction dB gain. I don't care if you did that with triple sub tuners. That tells me what the device is capable of doing. That's almost, let me think, 8 dB more gain that I can get out of the device I've been using. That's impressive. That means at least one driver stage of one of the cascaded stages in the driver chain has been eliminated because of the gain of the final. And if that's got in the equivalent of 81 or 82 biasing characteristics, if that's got anything close to 40% efficiency on a two-tone test, that's a darn nice device. That's been around how long, Glenn? And MRF suggests it's Motorola. Do you think Motorola is still manufacturing it? Back to you, Glenn.
Oh, absolutely. They're still manufacturing it. I was giving samples. I got about 10 samples of it. It even comes from Rojas now, so you can get it lead-free. So it's pretty well wide distributed. You can get a hold of it. So this is really not a hard part to get a hold of. As a matter of fact, it's one of the more modern. Even though a lot of the 900 megahertz stuff is becoming rare, when I was asking about 900 megahertz from some of my suppliers, they were like, why do you want to work there? But, yeah, it was kind of an experiment with it. I built it on a very, very staff test fixture that I put together where I didn't even mount the part down. I just had one of those little clamps that holds it down in one of my little test fixtures. But, yeah, no, this part's definitely available. And what's nice about it is it's available in surface mount as well.
Very nice. By the way, have I told you I'm learning to hate Rojas? That I intentionally go out and buy non-Rojas solder? And I'm hearing stronger and stronger opinions from people in the Department of Defense saying you will not supply Rojas equipment to us. It has questionable reliability. It's got latent failures built into it because it grows whiskers. Or I guess there's a nickel or titanium. I can't think of the name of the metal. It grows whiskers and creates short circuits. So Rojas, for the Department of Defense, I'm coming to the conclusion it may be the wrong stuff. Back to you on that one, Glenn.
Tin whiskers.
That's what I was trying to think of, tin whiskers. Back to you, Glenn.
Yes, tin whiskers and dendrite. But, yeah, there again, I think it goes back to what you said earlier. It depends on what you're used to. If you're already used to the higher temperatures and going stuff into Europe, and that's kind of where everybody's going. I know for now there's quite a few places where, because everybody's not, their processes aren't up to speed yet. There's still a lot of lead out there, but eventually it's all going to go away.
For the military.
What was that to Steve? Are you saying that the military will still allow lead? Is that your prediction, Steve?
Are you kidding me? All the military contractors, they insist on it. You will not sell us Rojas part, period. The Italians are really bad with the environment.
Good question. Okay. That's what I'm hearing also. The Department of Defense is saying you will not send us Rojas equipment. We don't like its reliability. To hell with the lead in the environment. We need reliability. Give me battle short capability. No? You want to go to another one? K2RIW?
Actually, you wouldn't know what they suggest you do. Do you use Rojas punk?
I'm listening.
Of course, send it out to be plated with basically solder. And you actually have to go through a qualification process to do it.
Wow. Go ahead, Howie.
I know that ICOM and a couple of the manufacturers are having problems selling equipment right now. They can't give you replacement parts for some of the equipment because they can't sell amateur stuff in Europe if it doesn't meet this new lead-free stuff. I don't know if you know about that.
Yeah, I do, and it's a pain. And I can see how it's going to take a long time for this tin whisker dendrite problem to settle out. Maybe it's a material problem, but I'm a little bit afraid it's going to be a little bit like is it Freon 12, I think, what it was, Halon. When you use Halon as a fire extinguisher, it works like a charm. And even though halon is a chlorofluorocarbon, which is dangerous to the atmosphere, they've been searching and searching and searching. They can't find anything that's anywhere near as good and extinguishes the fire as halon. So you can outlaw halon in your building if you want to. The only slight problem is your building will burn down. And is that safer? You can save the atmosphere, but lose your building and lose the people that are in the building. I'm not convinced it's a good trade-off. So RoHS and halon are two serious problems for which I don't think there's a simple solution. I think we're going to have to really struggle about this one for a long time to come. Okay, and that's a whole philosophy of politics and whatever we can get into for a long time. Why don't you try one more if you think you can squeeze it in. The choice is yours, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Welcome to the W2.
Okay. One thread that was quite interesting. He purchased a 6-meter amplifier that uses a pair of 8874. Oh, how you like that? And he says the guy who he purchased it from at a amp bench says that you can. You can refer to K2RIW that is built on a similar design. I don't remember you putting anything like that together, Dick. Using those tubes and all. On a similar configuration of his grip line, kilowatt for 432. And he wants pneumatic things, and all of us know if we can help him out with pneumatic theory of operation and all. So far, the amplifier seems to be pretty good, but what do I do in the future with this thing? I need some work. So, very well built, he says, very professionally built. And he wants to know if this is the 6-meter version of it. Dick, did you ever alter anything to 6 meters over?
No, I didn't, but my buddies did. First of all, the so-called parallel kilowatt amplifier, for a whole lot of years, was manufactured by a man named Fred Merry, M-E-R-R-Y, in Greenbush, New York. He came out with a 432 version, a 2-meter version, and a 6-meter version. I don't think he came out with the 220 version. Lately, there is, I can't think of what it's called, it's a guy in Connecticut. My goodness. Oh, K1FO, that's right. K1 Far Out, Steve Polishin. Steve Polishin has a series of parallel kilowatt amplifiers, extremely well manufactured, beautiful looking pieces of equipment. For 432, 2 meters, I think there's a 220 version, I know he's got a 6 meter version. So you go to the K1FO, Steve Polishin website, and Rich, what is the name of his company?
Geostep.
That was his old name of his old company. The new company, if you look up K1FO, K1 Far Out, Steve Polishin, and I'm not sure I know the name of his new company. He is making that amplifier in beautiful form. So you'll get some data there. Fred Merry, for lots of years, was designing and building those amplifiers. I didn't do it. He did it. He made his own version of each of those. Unfortunately, Fred Merry is now a silent key. But Steve Polishin, K1FO, has taken over much of that and gone on and designed some very nice parallel kilowatt amplifiers for each of those bands. So if you look up Steve Polishin, I think you're going to get a lot of the information you're looking for. That's about the best I think I can offer on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
It's called Directive Systems.
Directive Systems is the Directive Systems is the antenna company in Lebanon, Maine, by K1WHS. That's a different guy. K1WHS, that's Directive Systems. K1 Far Out is a different company. We haven't heard it yet. Thank you for trying, sir. You got it, Mel.
Gotcha. Yeah, Fred Merry. I knew him quite well some years ago. He would sub you to GN, am I correct?
You got it. I had trouble thinking of it. Whiskey 2, Golf November. But he's now a silent key, and much of that has been modernized by K1 Far Out. Back to you, Mel.
Vic?
Go ahead, Rich.
A real quick question before we lose the repeater.
Okay. We'll take you. Go ahead.
Okay, because I'm going to do it this week. If I do the neutralization on the 8877 and later change that three coil, will it affect the neutralization?
The answer is 95% no. When you change that coil, the straight capacitance to ground is going to change a little bit. And that is part of the neutralization. But it's going to be a relatively minor perturbation. I think I've heard you during the week saying that you've bought the neutralization kit. I think it has arrived. You're in the process of installing it or have installed it. And the way you tune it, if you do have the ability to tune it, I think it's by bending little pieces of metal slightly, I think the amount of retuning when you change the coil is going to be very minor. I think the neutralization is reasonably broadband, that if you didn't retune it, it would be good enough. But the scientist in you is going to want the neutralization to be on the money, and you're going to have to retune it by 5% when you change the coil. Now back to you, Rich.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, this neutralization kit is used on AL-1200. Which is 3CX1202, and I'm going to use back to you, Dick, 2EL.
Yeah, when you're adjusting your neutralization, 95% what you're doing is you're canceling electronically. You're electronically canceling the capacitance that's inside of the tube. That's the dominant capacitor of that circuit. The little bit of stray capacitance, you've got the coils on the outside, that's a secondary effect, fairly minor, so I wouldn't worry. Back to you, Mel, the choice is yours. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Thank you very much, Dick.
You got it, Mel.
Okay, yeah, more of a question to be asked here. Yeah, and this one would have been good. I think Fred Murray may have been the person that put this together. Yes, here about ALC. Can I add ALC? Is there an ALC circuit in there? Boy, oh boy, I don't remember. I think some of the later amplifiers, the strip line type of amplifiers, I think there was a modification that came up to add ALC, if I'm not mistaken. Am I correct? Over.
I have never seen an ALC on a parallel kilowatt amplifier on any band. There is a chance that Steve K1FO has added it to his amplifiers. He's put in all kinds of bandpass filters to make sure that it's got lots of dB of margin on meeting the FCC harmonic specs, out-of-band frequency response, and all that kind of jazz. So if anybody has put in ALC, K1FO has. Fred Merry, W2GN, awful nice, hardworking, sincere guy. But he was a little bit light on some of the theory, and the chances that he put in ALC, I think, is small. Not zero, but I think it's small. And by the way, the right place to put in ALC usually is in the driver stage. If your ALC of the driver stage of your driver 432 transmitter or your 6-meter transmitter is working correctly and properly controlling the peak envelope power, then there shouldn't be a requirement for an additional ALC on the afterburner. So if your driver stage has enough ALC, that should solve 95% of the problem, in my opinion. The amplifier itself has got a little bit of reserve, and it's not going to flat top on you if you're driving it correctly. We've only got a couple minutes to go. I'm going to start saying 73s. We believe that this is September 30th, and we think this is our 25th anniversary tech test. September of 1982 is when it began, the end of September of 1982. So this was TechNet number 1155, and I believe this is the 25th anniversary. Happy anniversary, Mel. K2KBY, go ahead and put on the ribbon, sir.
The first TechNet was on 00 repeat.
You got it. Guy's got a good memory. You got it, Mel.
Okay, roger, roger. Yeah, you had a number of other questions about the amplifier and all, such as a harmonic trap assembly that was added. Gee, I don't know. I don't know what was added. I can say you got me, you know, with a lot of these things, the ALC added and everything, changeover to Zoom from the original 450 to, well, let's put it this way. I know there was a number of different triode amplifiers and all that were constructed around this type of configuration. So I'll just have to let it go like that. But maybe I think that go look to K1FO or whatever, maybe get some more further information on it. I think that's about all. I can't recall any other particular project. It does go back a few years. I had built one. The 2-meter version worked quite well. It's still in operation. So, with that, thank you everybody for joining us, 73 for all. And yes, we are very happy to be here for this 25th. And hopefully we can do another 25. Hopefully. And we'll see everybody next week. 73, this is KTY.
Dick and Mel, Dick, thank you very much for many years of knowledge. Learned a lot listening to you guys, WD2HWW.
Another good testimonial. Yeah, to my knowledge, Fred Mary, W2GN, did not add the harmonic filters. K1FO did. He got some very simple coaxial stuff, semi-rigid coax cables, quarter-inch diameter coax cable filters built into the amplifier to control the harmonics. K1FO did do that. Steve Polishin. He's the guy that's got the filter that you might want to add if you want to control the harmonics. He's the only guy I know who's done it, and he's done it very well. He's a very enthusiastic, very thorough engineer. You got to get a hold of him. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. See you next week. K2RAW, SecNet Landmark. We're clear for now.
I think, you know, those amplifiers, at least the 2-meter one, was published in Cam Radio Magazine. Some may want to get hold of the appropriate issue. ARRL sells back issues of Cam Radio. And with W2GN, a company called Argos, I believe that was the song.
That's the guy, Arcos, A-R-C-O-S, Amateur Radio Component Service, Arcos. Fred Mary, W2GN, it was a ham radio article for the 2-meter version, and I'm glad to hear that back issues of ham radio are available from USB. Sounds good. Bye-bye, you all.
Rich, meet me up on my machine.
Hey, how are you? 2-meter.